Hi, you're listening to Screen of the Crime, a podcast where we talk about true crime and what would happen if your favorite TV or movie characters committed those crimes. I'm Maggie, and today my guest is...
Hi, I'm Bella. I'm so excited to be here. Talking to Maggie, talking about crime.
Would you like to say a little bit about yourself? Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
So I am a student at Wellesley College up in Massachusetts. I'm home right now because of the pandemic, and Florida is beautiful and sunny and not cold.
That's true. It's really nice here, actually. All the leaves have changed colors, and it's not, like, snowing. So, last week's guest, it had just snowed in Minnesota, and it was awful.
Oh, Minnesota's so cold.
Mm-hmm. So, before we actually start, I just want to make an announcement that Bella actually likes Julian the Phantoms, and she is the only one who I know who actually appreciates the show. So, we have that in common. Who's your favorite character?
I'm such a simp for Luke. I really am. My little sister and I, who watched the show together, we have decided that Luke is our white boy of the month that we are simping over. But honestly, all of the characters are so great. And you really have to put it out there for Madison Reyes, who's playing Julie, because, you know, it's so awesome to see people of color, like, in leading roles, and it's her first acting role. And for 16 years old, that girl's got pipes. She can sing.
Especially coming from you, since you know how to sing as well.
Oh, man, my singing days are in the past, Maggie. Are you listening? Yes, Maggie and I went to a arts high school, and I was a vocal major. So That's where that comes from.
Madison Reyes, I found her TikTok. She has two TikToks, but I found one of them, and she's really funny. I mean, like, she's really got that Gen Z humor going on, and you can see it in the interviews that she has with the cast, because no one knows what she's talking about when she's like, not the blah, 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 you know, and everyone's like, huh? What? Because they're all 21. But I think it's funny. Mm-hmm. I like Alex, personally. I think it's really great that they have, a gay character in there, especially from 1995. Kenny Ortega actually said in an interview that he had Alex in there, and, like, making him come out wasn't, like, a part of the show, because in his childhood, like, that wasn't, like, a thing you would see. Like, no one told him that it was, like, accepted to be gay and stuff like that. So it's cool that he has Alex in there. Also, the actor, he's, like, a child star from, like, Disney or something. So he has a bunch of vlogs online, and he is honestly hilarious.
Aww. Yeah, I love that, like, Alex's character arc, you know, it wasn't about him coming out, you know, it was just something that was a part of him, and all his friends already, like, knew and accepted it, because I feel like you don't see that a lot. Like, if there's gay characters in a show, then usually there's some big coming out scene where everyone's like, and
you're gay, yeah,
you're gay, but Alex is just, he's gay, like, that's it, he's comfortable with it, he knows it, love that.
Yeah. Also, Boo Boo Stewart, of course, is amazing.
Who doesn't love Boo Boo Stewart?
He's great. Anyway, so this episode's technically my Halloween episode, because Halloween is on Saturday, and this comes out on Wednesday before that Saturday. So I decided to do a case that involved Halloween. However, in my googly searches, I don't know why I said it like that, there's not a lot of cases that actually happen on Halloween, except for one that I did last year with the poisoned candy, which was just some guy trying to kill his children or something like that. So this case technically happens on Halloween. Part of it does. But the rest of it's really not at all about Halloween whatsoever. But I would like to give a couple warnings about this case, because it does involve rape, a lot of it. And it's really sadistic. So if you don't want to hear that, not you, Bella, but the audience, you have to be here.
I signed up for that.
Yeah, I would recommend skipping halfway through to whenever Bella speaks, or just not listening to it and listening to last year's episode about Halloween. But since we're here, let's get into it. This is about the Toolbox Murderers. So we're going to start with Shirley Lynette Ledford. On October 31st, 1979, 16-year-old Shirley Lynette Ledford was abducted as she stood outside a gas station, hitchhiking home from a Halloween party in Sunland, Tujunga suburbs of Los Angeles. She recognized one of the abductors because he was known to have frequented the restaurant that she worked at as a waitress. His name was Roy Norris, and the other man was Lawrence Bataker. Upon accepting the offer of a lift home and entering the van, Ledford was offered marijuana by Norris, but she refused because she's a good person. Bataker drove the van to a secluded street where Norris drew a knife and then bound and gagged Ledford with construction tape. Bataker then traded places with Norris, who drove in an aimless manner for an excess of an hour, as Bataker remained with Ledford in the back of the van. After removing the construction tape from the girl's mouth and legs, Bataker tormented Ledford, initially slapping and mocking her, then beating her with his fists as he repeatedly shouted for her to say something. Then, as Ledford began screaming, shouting for her to scream louder. As Ledford continued screaming, Bataker began asking her as he struck her, "What's the matter? Don't you like to scream?" Which is weird. As Ledford began... Yeah, it is. As Ledford began to cry, she pleaded with Bataker, saying, "No, don't touch me." In response, Bataker again ordered her to scream as loud as she wished, then began alternately striking her with a hammer, beating her breast with his fist, and tormenting her with pliers, both between and throughout instances when he raped and sodomized her. So all out, horrible, awful, disgusting. We hate them.
Thank God for Uber.
I mean, yeah. No more hitchhiking.
No more hitchhiking, please.
Repeatedly, Ledford can be heard pleading for the abuse to cease and making statements such as, "Oh no, no," as sounds of Bataker alternately extracting either the sledgehammer or the pliers from the toolbox can be heard on a tape recording he had switched on after entering the rear of the van, so he recorded the whole thing. Norris later described, quote, "screams, constant screams," emanating from the rear of the van as he drove. Shortly after Norris switched places with Bataker, he himself switched on the tape recorder that Bataker had used to record much of the time he had been in the rear of the van. Norris first shouted for Ledford to go ahead and scream or I'll make you scream. In response, Ledford said, "I'll scream if you stop hitting me," which is a smart thing to say.
It is.
After everything she's been through. But then she admitted several high-pitched screams as Norris encouraged her to continue until he ordered her to stop. Norris then reached for the sledgehammer as Shirley Ledford, seeing him do this, screamed, "Oh no."
Yikes.
Norris then struck Ledford once upon the left elbow. In response, she informed Norris he had broken her elbow before pleading, "Don't hit me again." In response, Norris again raised the sledgehammer as Ledford repeatedly screamed no. Norris then proceeded to strike Ledford 25 consecutive times upon the same elbow with the sledgehammer before asking her, quote, "What are you sniffling about?" as Ledford continuously screamed and wept. After approximately 2 hours of captivity, Norris killed Ledford by strangling her with a wire coat hanger, which he tightened with pliers. Ledford did not react much to the strangulation, although she died with her eyes open. Bataker then opted to discard her body on a random lawn in order to view the reaction from the press. The pair drove to a randomly selected house in Sunland and discarded Ledford's body in a bed of ivy upon the front lawn. Ledford's body was found by a jogger the following morning. An autopsy revealed that in addition to having been sexually violated, she had died of strangulation after receiving extensive blunt force trauma to the face, head, breast, and left elbow, with her olecranon, I think I pronounced that correctly. Did I say it wrong?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, that sustained multiple fractures. I don't know what that is. I'm assuming it's her head.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it. Her genitalia and rectum had been torn, caused in part by Bataker having inserted pliers inside her body.
Yikes.
Awful, horrible.
Really, really, disgusting. Really bad. Why do people hate women so much?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I was doing these notes yesterday with my roommate was in the room, and I was like, you know, there's very little cases of a woman murdering people and sexually assaulting them, like, to any degree. But, like, men are just like, "I hate women." And are just fucking the worst people ever.
Yeah, just drinking the "I hate women" juice. Mommy didn't love me, and therefore any woman who rejects me, I'm just gonna kill them.
Yeah, exactly. They need that dominance in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, her left hand bore a puncture wound, and a finger on her right hand had been slashed. Bataker, I'm pronouncing his name wrong, and I literally looked it up right before we started recording. And I can't recall how to pronounce it, so I'm just going to keep saying it like that because he doesn't deserve to have his name pronounced correctly.
You know what? Consistency is key.
Exactly. He would later claim that the tape recording the pair had created at Ledford's Clear abuse and torture offered nothing other than the evidence of a threesome, adding that towards the very end, Shirley Ledford was screaming for him and Norris to kill her. So that's dumb of him to say because it's wrong.
Yeah, you know, I think at that point, most people would be wishing for death, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like at least it's going to stop. I'm telling you, I recently broke my finger, and it was not fun. I cannot imagine having a broken elbow, and then, you know, they keep hitting it.
Yeah. No, it's probably really awful, and they were going to kill her anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered.
Exactly.
So that was a lot to take in. That was our Halloween murder. So I'm going to back it up, and we're going to talk about these two disgusting, awful, horrible men.
All right. So, give us the background. Did mommy not love them?
yeah, actually. So Lawrence Bataker was born Lawrence Sigmund Bataker in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 27th, 1940, as the unwanted child of a couple who had chosen not to have children.
There it is.
So, there it is. He was placed in an orphanage by his natural mother and was adopted by Mr. and Mrs. George Bataker as an infant. Bataker's adopted father worked in the aviation industry, which required the family to frequently move around the United States throughout his childhood. So he didn't stay in Pittsburgh. Bataker was first arrested for shoplifting at the age of 12 and obtained a minor criminal record over the next 4 years after further arrests for the same offense, in addition to petty theft, which brought him to the attention of the juvenile authorities. Bataker would later claim that these numerous theft-related offenses committed throughout his adolescence have been attempts to compensate for the lack of love he received from his parents. Dumbass. Anyway. Although reportedly to have an IQ of 138, which is good, Bataker considered school to be tedious and dropped out of high school in 1957. By this stage in his adolescence, he and his adoptive parents were living in California. Within a year of dropping out, he had been arrested for car theft, a hit and run, and evading arrest. For these offenses, he was imprisoned at the California Youth Authority, where he remained until he was 18 years old. Upon release, Bataker discovered his adoptive parents had disowned him and had relocated to another state. He would never see his adoptive parents again. Abandoned, so the next guy. Twice. Abandoned twice.
That's some deep-seated issues right there.
Yeah, it totally excuses all of the rape and murder he committed in his life.
You know what? There are healthier ways to seek attention if you are feeling unloved. This is why people need good teachers in their lives. You know, I feel like a good teacher, someone you could confide in, some sort of adult figure, like maybe so many people wouldn't end up so nutso.
I agree completely. I mean, it was like the 40s and 50s, so yeah. It's not the best time. But that being said, he's still a bad guy.
Definitely still a bad guy. Does not excuse that kind of sadistic, horrible behavior towards women.
Yep. So the next guy is Ray Norris. He was born in Greeley, Colorado on February 5th, 1948. Norris was conceived out of wedlock. His parents had married to avoid the social stigma surrounding illegitimate birth at the time, and Norris's extended family lived within a short distance of his parents' home due to his grandfather's real estate investments. His father worked in a scrapyard, and his mother was a drug-addicted housewife, to put it bluntly. He occasionally lived with his parents throughout his childhood and adolescence, but was repeatedly placed in the care of foster families throughout the state of Colorado. Norris's childhood recollections were interspersed with memories of wrongful accusations while living with his biological parents and of being neglected by many of the foster families he lived with, frequently being denied sufficient food or clothing. He also claimed to have been sexually abused in the care of a Hispanic family, later stating the prejudice he held towards Hispanic people originated from the neglect and abuse he endured as a child when placed in the care of his family. While living with his birth parents at the age of 16, Norris visited the home of a female relative who was in her early 20s and began speaking to her in a sexually suggestive manner. She ordered him to leave her house and informed Norris's father, who threatened to subject him to a beating. Norris subsequently stole his father's car and drove into the Rocky Mountains, where he attempted to commit suicide by injecting pure air into the artery of his arm. Which is a weird way to commit suicide.
That is.
Yeah. We have another episode of this. It was Emily's episode where he kept trying to kill himself. Just weird ways to kill yourself. These men, like, do they even want to die? I don't know. Also, where'd he get the it's not important. I'm not going to keep questioning.
Yeah, well, how do you inject pure air into your, like, do you fill a syringe with air and then, like,
inject it? I would assume so, but where'd he get the syringe?
Hey, you know what? People who inject heroin seem to have no trouble finding syringes, so.
You're right. He was later apprehended as a runaway and returned to live with his parents. Upon his return home, Norris's parents informed him that he and his younger sister were unwanted children and that they intended to divorce when both reached adolescence. A year later, Norris dropped out of school and joined the United States Navy, which they just accept anyone.
Wasn't the guy from Emily's episode also in the Navy?
Yeah, they're really just accepting crazy kids, which makes you wonder about the Navy.
Right? We're just like, you know, we're going to accept all of these people, and then we're going to give them combat training.
Right? And then we're going to release them back into the world if they don't die. It's like, oh, no. That's not great.
Thank you, U.S. military industrial complex.
Yep. He was stationed in San Diego in 1965 and was deployed to Vietnam in 1969, although he did not see active combat during his four-month tour on duty. He was honorably discharged from the Navy after one tour of duty. Their first offenses, the baby's firsts. So Bataker, within days of his parole from the California Youth Authority, Bataker was arrested for transporting a stolen vehicle across state lines. In August of 1959, Bataker was sentenced to 18 months imprisonment to be served at the Oklahoma State Reformatory. He was later transferred to the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri, to serve the remainder of his sentence. In 1960, Bataker was released from prison and soon reverted to crime. Within months of his release, he had been arrested in Los Angeles for robbery, and in May of 1961 was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. While incarcerated for his robbery, he was diagnosed by a psychiatrist as being highly manipulative, which I didn't know was a diagnosis, but...
This is a guy who was smart, right? Smart people often know how to talk their way out of things, or talk people into things, right?
No, I agree, but is, like, being highly manipulative, like, a medical diagnosis?
No, but it definitely could serve as, like, a warning. Like, yo, you know, if you see this guy with a whole bunch of other inmates, they might be planning something.
The psychiatrist also described Bataker as, quote, having considerable concealed hostility. So, he's angry. Bataker was released on parole in 1963 after completing 2 years of his sentence. In October 1964, he again was imprisoned for a parole violation. In 1966, Bataker underwent further examinations by two independent psychiatrists, both of whom classified him as a borderline psychopath, a highly manipulative individual unable to acknowledge the consequences of his actions. Bataker explained to one of them that his criminal activities gave him a feeling of self-importance, although he insisted circumstantial matters pertaining to his environment and upbringing decreased his ability to resist committing crimes.
That's probably true. You know, you grow up unloved, you lash out, you commit petty crimes, and then when people pay attention to you, it's like, aha, people are paying attention to me. What if I became one of these serial killers that goes down in history that everybody remembers my name? This is why we can't name serial killers, man. The people are interested in them, but the fame goes to their heads, and then we inspire a whole new generation of serial killers.
Yeah, that's true. Like the Zodiac Killer, all he wanted was to be put in the newspapers.
Right? Ted Cruz is a Zodiac Killer. Continue.
Bataker was prescribed antipsychotic medication. A year later, he was again released into society. A month after his parole in July of 1967, Bataker was again arrested and convicted of theft and of leaving the scene of an accident. He was sentenced to 5 years, but was released in April of 1970. In March of 1971, Bataker was again arrested for burglary. Due to his repeated parole violations, he was sentenced to 6 months to 15 years imprisonment in October of 1971. Three years later?
That's a big range.
It is a big range. 3 years later, Bataker was released from prison. So he got 3 years.
Okay.
In 1974, Bataker was arrested for assault with attempt to commit murder after stabbing a young supermarket employee who had accused him of stealing. The supermarket employee had observed him stealing a steak and had followed him outside into the store parking lot, where he asked Bataker whether he had forgotten to pay. And then Bataker responded by stabbing him in the chest and narrowly missing his heart. Attempt to flee.
Yeah. If that was a female supermarket employee, we don't follow people. Them. Well, no, we don't follow people to dark parking lot. You know?
That's true. Yeah, I was like, if I saw someone steal something and then leave, like, I'm not going to risk my life for it. I don't work on commission.
Yeah, like, if you were stealing in the store and I was confronting you, like, there are lights, there are cameras, you know?
But I'm not going to be like, excuse me, did you forget to pay $15 for that steak and then get killed? You know, it's like, that's not worth it.
Not worth it.
It's not even my steak. He attempted to flee, but was quickly restrained by two other supermarket employees. The employee, Gary Louie, survived the stabbing, and Bataker was convicted of the lesser charge of assault with a deadly weapon and sent to California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo.
Obispo.
So, let's talk about Ray Norris and his firsts. In November of 1969, Norris was arrested for his first known sexual offense. He was charged with both rape and assault with attempt to commit rape. In the latter incident, he had attempted to force his way into the car of a lone woman. 3 months later, in February of 1970, Norris attempted to deceive a lone woman into allowing him to enter her home. When the woman refused, he attempted to break into her house, and the woman phoned the police, who arrested Norris, before he had the opportunity to cause the woman any harm. Less than 3 months after this offense, Norris was diagnosed by military psychologists with severe schizoid personality. He was given an administrative discharge from the Navy under the terms labeled as psychological problems. Just put him out into society.
Yeah, people with psychological problems are no longer the military's problem.
Yep. And now they have the skills to kill people. And they're not going to tell anyone. In May of 1970, Norris, on bail for his latest offense, attacked a female student whom he had been stalking on the grounds of the San Diego State University campus. Norris repeatedly struck her on the back of the head with a rock until she slumped to her knees before he repeatedly beat her head against the sidewalk as he knelt upon her lower back. Shortly thereafter, Norris was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. He was committed to a total of 5 years imprisonment at the Atascardo State Hospital, where he was classified as a mentally disordered sex offender. Norris was released from that hospital in 1975 with 5 years probation, having been declared by doctors as an individual who was of no further danger to others. But he is. Just 3 months after this release, Norris approached a 27-year-old woman walking home from a restaurant in Redondo Beach. That can't be correct. And offered her a ride on his motorcycle. When she declined, Norris parked his motorcycle, grabbed the woman's scarf, twisted it around her neck before informing her he intended to rape her and dragging her into a nearby bush. Fearing for her life, the woman did not resist the rape. Although the rape was reported to police, they were initially unable to find the perpetrator. However, 1 month later, the victim observed Norris's motorcycle and noted the license number, which she immediately gave to the police. Norris was arrested for the rape. 1 year later, he was tried and convicted for his offense and sent to the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo.
Obispo. There you go.
While incarcerated at the Men's Colony, Norris met and befriended Bataker. And this is where the bromance began.
There it is.
So they became loosely acquainted in 1977, 1 year after Norris arrived at San Luis Obispo.
There you go.
Bataker's initial impression of Norris upon his arrival at the California Men's Colony was that he was a savvy individual who largely associated with hardened criminals from motorcycle gangs, in addition to dealing in contraband drugs. So they became acquainted and began talking in friendly terms when Norris taught Bataker how to construct jewelry. Romantic.
Wow, DIY together.
They're just making earrings together in prison. According to Norris, Bataker saved him from being attacked by fellow inmates on at least two occasions, and by 1978, the pair had become close acquaintances, discovering they shared a common interest in sexual violence and misogyny.
Wow.
Wow. When you and the bros love to be misogynistic together.
Exactly. Sounds like a fraternity.
Yeah. With Norris also divulging to Bataker, the biggest stimulation for him was seeing frightened young women. Adding that this was the primary reason he had amassed a lengthy record for sexual offenses. Bataker, who's not known to have committed any sexual offenses prior to meeting Norris, himself divulged to Norris that if he ever raped a woman, he would have to kill her, as to not leave a witness for the crime. That kind of reminds me of that John Mulaney quote when he's like, if you've like met my parents and seen my dick, you have to die. That's what it reminds me of. He's just like, no woman can survive after I rape her, you know? It's just, that's what. When alone, the pair regularly discussed plans to assault and murder teenage girls once they were freed. I'm starting to think prison isn't a great place. Their shared fantasy evolved into an elaborate plan to murder one girl of each teenage year from 13 through 19. The pair vowed to become reacquainted once they were released. Bataker was released from the California Men's Colony on October 15, 1978, and returned to Los Angeles and found work as a skilled mechanic. This work earned Bataker close to $1,000 a week, which is pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah, right? And despite cost...
I don't make that much when I was in college and working jobs.
I make like $500 every 2 weeks. It's truly the worst.
Yeah, I made like... Okay, I was only working part-time, but I made like $80 a week, $100 a week, like...
Yeah.
Poor.
So he's making good money.
He's making good money.
Why a felon?
When you're making good money, you know?
Exactly.
Find something else to do. Keep making your DIY earrings.
Yeah, start an Etsy shop. Come on, Bataker. And despite classifying himself as a loner, he became friendly with several people in his neighborhood, earning a reputation as a generous and helpful individual who occasionally donated money to the Salvation Army. On one occasion, he is known to have purchased large quantities of fast food and wine, and then he handed them out to homeless people in downtown Los Angeles. The wine's an interesting part of that, but, like, it's nice of him.
Yeah.
3 months after Bataker was released from the California Men's Colony on January 15, 1979, Norris was released from prison and moved into his mother's home in Redondo Beach. He soon found employment as an electrician in Compton. Shortly thereafter, he received a letter from Bataker. In late February, the pair met at a hotel and rekindled their plan to kidnap and rape girls. The murders! Woo!
Yes!
From February to June of 1979, Bataker and Norris picked up over 20 female hitchhikers. The pair did not assault these girls in any manner. These practice runs were merely a way for them to develop ruses to lure girls into the van voluntarily and of discovering secluded locations.
Why is it always a van?
I actually left this part out, but they did have a long conversation that they couldn't have a car because there wasn't enough space in the car to rape the girls, so they chose a van. It was a section of text about that.
It's always a van, man. Vans are sketchy. Never get into a van.
That's, of course, why would I ever get into a van unless I owned said van? In April, late April, the pair discovered a secluded fire road located in San Gabriel Mountains. Bataker broke the locked gate to this fire road with a crowbar and replaced the lock with one that he owned. So, victim number one, Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. She was 16 years old, and they killed her on June 24, 1979. Schaefer was last seen leaving a Presbyterian church meeting in Redondo Beach. In his written accounts of the event of this day, Bataker stated he and Norris first finished constructing the bed the pair had installed in the rear of the van, beneath which they placed tools, clothes, a cooler filled with beer, and soft drinks. At approximately 11 a.m., the pair drove to the beach area, drinking beer, smoking grass, and flirting with girls. They had no set routine. That's a quote. At approximately 7:46 p.m., so they were there for 9 hours, Norris spotted Schaefer walking down the side street and remarked to Bataker, "There's a cute little blonde." After unsuccessfully attempting to entice Schaefer into their van with alternative offers of marijuana and a lift home, Bataker and Norris drove further ahead and parked alongside a driveway. Norris then exited the vehicle, opened the passenger side sliding door and leaned into the van, with his head and shoulders obscured from view behind the door. When Schaefer passed the van, Norris exchanged a few words with her before dragging her into the van and closing the door. So they just grabbed her. Using a ruse that they would repeat in most of their subsequent murders, Petacre turned the radio to full volume as Norris bound the victim's arms and legs and gagged her with duct tape as Petacre drove Schaefer to the fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains, where, in April, the pair had previously switched the locks. Despite initially screaming when she was abducted, Schaefer quickly regained her composure. In his written account of the night that followed, Petacre wrote that Schaefer, quote, displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. I guess she knew what was coming. Which is so rude to say, yeah. You know?
No, maybe she was just trying to stay alive.
Yeah, right? Like, good on her for being a strong woman.
Yeah.
And fuck Petacre. Sucks.
That.
At the fire road, Norris first raped Schaefer after instructing Petacre to go take a walk and return in 1 hour. Because it's gay if he's in the van.
Of course. No,
they didn't say that. I said that. Okay. Upon returning to the van, Petacre similarly raped the girl in Norris's absence. Upon the second occasion in which she was raped by Norris in Petacre's absence, Schaefer asked him whether they intended to kill her, to which Norris replied, no. In response, Schaefer requested to be allowed time to pray before she was killed, if that was Petacre and Norris's intention. In their subsequent accounts of the actual murder, Petacre and Norris gave differing accounts as to who argued over whether they should kill her or rather release her. Each stated that the other argued that they should kill her.
At that point, you know, they're looking to lower their sentence, right?
Yeah.
Please don't kill me. The other guy told me to kill her.
Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, we both raped and abused her, but I didn't want to kill her.
I didn't want to kill her.
In any event, Schaefer pleaded for only a second to pray before Norris attempted to manually strangle her. After approximately 45 seconds, he became disturbed at the look in her eyes and ran to the front of the van, vomiting. Petacre then manually strangled Schaefer until she collapsed to the ground and began convulsing. He then twisted a wire coat hanger around her neck with a vice grip plier until Schaefer's convulsions ceased. Schaefer was denied her request to pray before Petacre and Norris killed her. Schaefer's body was wrapped in a plastic shower curtain and thrown over the steep canyon Petacre had selected. According to Norris, after Petacre had thrown Schaefer over the canyon, Petacre assured him, quote, the animals would eat her up, so there wouldn't be any evidence left. The next murder.
Nathan.
Andrea Joy Hall. They only killed 5 people. So okay. We're halfway there.
Yes. Five, we say. Only 5.
I mean, it's a lot, and these people are awful, but, I mean, we don't have to, like, listen to detailed account of, like, 20 people getting raped and murdered.
This is true. It's true.
So, on July 8th, 1979, 2 weeks after the murder of Schaefer, Petacre and Norris encountered 18-year-old Andrea Joy Hall hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. As the pair slowed the van to offer Hall a lift, another vehicle pulled over and offered Hall exactly that, which she accepted. Petacre and Norris followed the vehicle from a distance until Hall exited the vehicle in Redondo Beach. On this occasion, Norris hid in the back of the van in order to dupe Hall into thinking Petacre was alone. Inside the van, Petacre offered Hall a cold drink from the cooler located in the rear of the van. Norris pounced on her when she went to retrieve it, and after a strenuous fight, managed to subdue Hall by twisting her arm behind her back, causing her to scream in pain. Norris then gagged Hall with adhesive tape and bound her wrists and ankles. Petacre and Norris drove Hall to a location in the San Gabriel Mountains, beyond where they had taken Schaefer. At this location, she was raped twice by Petacre and once by Norris. While Petacre was raping Hall for the second time, Norris saw what he believed to be a vehicle headlights approaching. Petacre clasped his hand over Hall's mouth and dragged her to a nearby bush as Norris drove in an unsuccessful search for the vehicle he thought he had seen. When he returned, the pair drove to a location farther into the San Gabriel Mountains. Petacre forced Hall to walk uphill naked alongside the road and then perform oral sex on him before ordering Hall to pose for several Polaroid pictures.
Gotta keep those memes.
Yeah. Sure won't come back to bite them in the ass. Petacre and Norris drove to a third location where Petacre, again, walked Hall up a nearby hill, this time as Norris drove to a nearby store to purchase alcohol. Then, when Norris returned, Pataker was alone and in possession of two further Polaroid pictures he had taken, both of which depicted Hall's face in expressions Norris later described as being of sheer terror, as she begged for her life to be spared. Pataker informed Norris that he had told Hall he was going to kill her and challenged her to give him as many reasons as she could to come as she could come up with as to why she should be allowed to live before thrusting an ice pick through her ear into her brain.
Oof.
He then turned her body over and thrust the ice pick into the other ear, stomping on it until the handle broke. Pataker then strangled her before throwing her body off a cliff.
Yay.
That's a lot of deep-seated anger there, man.
Yeah, I personally believe Pataker is the worst of the two, and it's kind of weird because he had never previously committed sexual crimes, and Norris had, but he seems like he's the one raping them the most.
You know,
personally.
If I've heard anything from Criminal Minds, there's always, when you get pair murderers, there's a dominant and a submissive. And you know what? You're talking, and I was like, well, Norris has to be the dominant because he's, like, manipulative and he's the one who's, like, got previous sexual assault history. But I feel like the power dynamic is shifting as they commit more murders.
Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that the first murder I talked about was their last murder. It's the worst murder of them all, I would say.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, that's the other thing I learned from Criminal Minds, escalation. The more mm-hmm. murders you commit, the worse they get.
So here are the last two, or they're not the last two, but the last two I'm going to discuss. Mm-hmm. Jackie Norris Gillum and Jacqueline Leigh Camp. On September 3rd, Pataker and Norris observed two girls named Jackie Doris Gilliam and Jacqueline Lake Lamp sitting at a bus stop bench located close to Hermosa Beach. Lamp and Gilliam had been hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway before Pataker and Norris observed them as they were resting at the bus stop. Pataker and Norris offered the girls a ride, which Gilliam and Lamp accepted. Inside the van, both girls were offered marijuana by Norris, which they accepted. Shortly after entering the van, both girls realized that Pataker had steered the van off the Pacific Coast Highway and was driving in the direction of the San Gabriel Mountains. When the girls protested, both Pataker and Norris attempted to allay the girls' concerns with excuses, which did not deceive the girls. Either girl, Lamp, age 13, attempted to open the sliding door, whereupon Norris hit her in the back of the head with a bag filled with lead weights, briefly knocking her unconscious before overpowering the other girl who was 15. These are young uns. As he began to bind and gag Gillum, Lamp regained consciousness and again attempted to flee the van, whereupon Norris twisted her arm behind her back and dragged her back into the van. As the struggle ensued, Pataker, noting the girl's struggle, was in full view of the potential witnesses, stopped the van, punched Gilliam in the face, and assisted Norris in finishing the binding and gagging of the two girls. Gilliam and Lamp were driven to the San Gabriel Mountains, where they were held captive for almost 2 days, being bound and gagged between repeated instances of sexual and physical abuse.
2 days.
2 days.
Both men slept in the van alongside the two hostages, with each alternatively acting as a lookout. On one occasion, Pataker walked Lamp into a nearby hill and forced her to pose for pornographic pictures before returning her to the van. Pataker also asked Norris to take several Polaroid pictures of herself, Gilliam, both nude and clothed. In the first of the three instances in which Pataker raped Gillian, he also created a tape recording of himself raping her, forcing the girl to pretend she was his cousin and informing Gilliam to feel free to express her pain. He later claimed that he buried the tape in a cemetery. The tape recording was never found.
Well, that's going to be an interesting archaeological find.
Right? It's going to be awful. Pataker is also known to have tortured Gilliam by stabbing her breast with an ice pick and using vice grip pliers to tear off part of one nipple. After almost 2 days of captivity, Lamp and Gilliam were murdered. At Pataker's subsequent trial, Norris claimed that he suggested that Gilliam be killed quickly, as unlike Lamp, she had been largely cooperative throughout the period of her captivity. Whereupon Pataker replied, no, they only die once anyway. Gilliam was struck in each ear with an ice pick and then strangled to death. After Pataker had murdered Gilliam, he then forced Lamp out of the van. Upon exiting the sliding door, Pataker shouted to her, quote, you want to stay a virgin? Now you can die a virgin, before Norris struck her upon the head with a sledgehammer. Pataker then strangled Lamp until he believed she had died. When Lamp opened her eyes, Norris again bludgeoned her repeatedly as Pataker strangled her to death. The bodies of Gilliam and Lamp were thrown over the embankment. All right, In 1979, Norris became acquainted with a friend named Joseph Jackson, an individual with whom he had previously been incarcerated at the California Men's Colony. Norris confided in this individual as to his and Bataker's exploits over the previous 5 months, including graphic details of the murders of Shirley Ledford, the only one whose body had been found at the time. Norris also divulged to Jackson that in addition to the 5 murders he and Bataker had committed, that there had been 3 additional incidents in which he and Bataker had abducted or attempted to abduct young women who had either successfully escaped their attacks or, in one instance, had actually been raped but released. Upon hearing Norris's confessions, Jackson consulted his attorney, who advised him to inform the authorities. Go Jackson.
Yeah, man. You know, you get out of prison, you're like, I'm going to start a new life for myself. I'm gonna walk away from a life of crime. And you meet up with one of your old prison buddies. He's like, yeah, man, I just super sadistically killed these 5 women. You know, that's like, I think you're nuts. And now I will go to the police.
Yeah.
So good for him.
So Jackson agreed. And he and his attorney formed the Los Angeles Police Department, so who in turn relayed the 2 men to the Hermosa Beach Police. Hermosa Beach Detective Paul Benham, that can't be how you pronounce it, but that's how I'm going to do it, was assigned to the investigation. He found that Jackson's statements about Norris matched some reports of the missing girls, and Norris had also stated that he and Bataker had sprayed mace in the face of a woman that they had raped. The young woman was named Robin Robeck. She had claimed that she was maced in the face and raped by 2 white men in their 30s and was unable to identify the assailants. Benham met with Robeck and showed her some mugshots. She was able to identify Norris and Bataker as the men who raped her. Upon linking Bataker and Norris to the rape of Robin Robeck, the Hermosa Beach police placed Norris under surveillance, and within days they had observed his dealing in marijuana.
So at least they got him for something. You know, it's crazy to me how many serial killers get caught for, like, totally unrelated things, you know?
Yeah, like the Son of Sam was caught for a parking ticket, I think.
Yeah, and like Jeffrey Dahmer was also caught for like something with his car.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then they were like, aha, man, this guy's like killing people.
They're like, wait, there's evidence of murder.
Excuse me, why is there blood in your car?
On November 20th, 1979, Norris was arrested by the Hermosa Beach Police for parole violation. The same day, at the Burbank Motel where he resided, Bataker was arrested for the rape of Robin Robeck. Although Robeck had been able to identify mugshots of Bataker and Norris, in a police lineup she was unable to positively identify them. Nonetheless, the police had observed Norris dealing in marijuana. Whereas Bataker had been in possession of drugs at the time of his arrest. Both were held on charges of parole violation. A search of Bataker's apartment revealed several Polaroid photographs, which were determined as depicting Hall and Gilliam, both of whom had been reported as missing earlier the same year. Inside Bataker's van, investigators discovered a sledgehammer, a plastic bag filled with lead weights, a book detailing how to locate police radio frequencies, a jar of Vaseline, 2 necklaces later confirmed to be those of the victims, and a tape recording of a young woman in obvious distress, screaming and pleading for mercy while being tortured and sexually abused. The mother of Ledford, named by Jackson as being one of the women whom Norris had confessed he and Bataker had killed, identified the voice on the tape as being that of her only daughter. The voices of the 2 men mocking and threatening Ledford in the process of her torture and abuse were identified as being Roy Norris and Lawrence Bataker.
Also found being a parent and having to listen to that.
That's awful. Also found in Bataker's motel were several bottles of various acidic materials. Investigators would later discover Bataker planned to use these upon their next victim. Inside Norris's apartment, police discovered a bracelet he had taken from Ledford's body as a souvenir. Also found at the home of both Bataker and Norris were Polaroid pictures of almost 500 teenage girls and young women, most of which had apparently been taken at Redondo Beach and Hermosa Beach, with others taken by Bataker at the Burbank High School. Most of these pictures had been taken without the girls' knowledge or consent. So, on November 30th...
These guys don't seem to be big on consent.
No, they don't. Also, like, why are you just keeping these things that could, like, get you convicted of murder? Like, don't
Remember,
you know?
They can't... What was it? One of the guys, like, was psychiatrically diagnosed with not being able to see consequences of his actions.
That's true. On November 30th, 1979, Norris attended a preliminary hearing in relation to the September 30 rape. By this stage, Norris was beginning to display visible signs of stress. At the hearing, Norris waived his Miranda rights before Detective Bynum and Deputy District Attorney Stephen Kay began questioning him, initially in relation to the rape of Robin Robeck, then in relation to the statements given to police by Joseph Jackson, and the evidence recovered from his and Bataker's residences. Initially, Norris flatly denied any involvement in any murders, rapes, or disappearances. However, when confronted with the evidence investigators had compiled, Norris began to confess, although he did attempt to portray Bataker as being more culpable in the murders than himself. In what Bynum and Kay later described as a casual, unconcerned manner, Norris divulged that he and Bataker had been in the habit of driving around areas such as the Pacific Coast Highway and randomly approaching girls whom they found attractive with offers of a ride, posing with the pair for photographs or marijuana. Most of those whom they approached rejected whatever given ruse Bataker and Norris used to entice them into the van, although four girls had accepted lifts from the pair and had been murdered, with a fifth victim, their first, being grabbed by force. Inside the van, the girls would typically be overpowered, bound hand and foot, gagged, and driven to locations deep within the San Gabriel Mountains, where they would be sexually assaulted by both men. Then, usually killed by strangulation with a wire coat hanger, although two of the victims had ice picks driven into their ears before being strangled. Norris just said this. He was just like, well, you asked, so here we go. Norris admitted to bludgeoning their first victim, Lamp, about the head with a sledgehammer as Bataker strangled her, and admitted to repeatedly striking Shirley Ledford upon the elbow with a sledgehammer before strangling her to death. The bottles of acid found at Bataker's motel, Norris stated, were intended for use upon the next victim they abducted, and acts of torture and humiliation had been committed against their victims for fun. According to Norris, the level of brutality Bataker had exhibited towards their victims had increased on each successive instance. They had successfully lured a girl into the van. Their final victim, Ledford, had actually pleaded to be killed in order for her agony to cease. Additionally, details by Norris provided further corroborating evidence to support his confession. For example, he knew that their first victim, Schaefer, had left a meeting at a Presbyterian church shortly before she was abducted, and that Schaefer had lost one shoe as she had been dragged into the Bataker's van. Norris also knew part of Shirley Ledford's ancestry was Hispanic, and that Bataker had unsuccessfully asked her to date him prior to October of 1979. In a press statement relating to the police investigation into the murders issued on February 7, 1980, Los Angeles County Sheriff Peter Pitches stated the victims had been subjected to, quote, sadistic and barbaric abuse, adding that five charges of first-degree murder would be sought against both Bataker and Norris. Sheriff Pitches also stated that in relation to the Polaroid pictures found in Bataker and Norris's apartment, police had located 60 of the young women depicted, none of whom had been harmed. Nonetheless, Pitches also stated that police had also identified 19 of the women depicted in the pictures as being individuals who had been reported missing, and that of these teenage girls and young women that may well have been murdered. Although Pitches did stress that they had no conclusive evidence to suggest that these additional 19 women photographed had fallen victim to Bataker and Norris. One of the individuals in the pictures that they found was that of a unidentified young white woman alone with Bataker and Norris in circumstances very similar to the pictures found depicting Hall, Lamp, and Gilliam. The young woman in the picture had never been identified. This photograph is indicative. There may have been one further victim whom neither Bataker or Norris ever mentioned in the investigation. Which is weird because Norris really gave it up, you know?
Yeah, he really just went for it, man.
Yeah, he was like, I don't want to go to jail, so let me tell you about it.
Well, he was going to go to jail.
Yeah, he was going to, I mean. Norris agreed to return to the mountains to help search for the bodies of the girls that he said that he killed, but none of the bodies were found by him at that time. On February 9th, 1980, the skeletonized bodies of Lamp and Gilliam were found at the bottom of a canyon alongside a dry river. The bodies were scattered over the area, and an ice pick was found still lodged inside the skull of Gilliam. In February of 1980, Norris and Bataker were formally charged with the murders of the five girls. Norris accepted a plea bargain to testify against Bataker in exchange for no death penalty.
There you go. That's it.
Penalty. So Norris pleaded guilty on four counts of first-degree murder, one count of second-degree murder, and two counts of rape and one count of robbery. Prior to his sentencing, Norris was reviewed by a probation officer who testified at his sentencing that Norris had again accused Pataker of the actual torture of their victims, and that for Norris himself, the feeling of power and dominance he had over the victims was the main overriding factor, as opposed to having sexual intercourse with them. But we been knew. We know that's the reason anyone has raped people.
Exactly.
Not about the sex. It's about the dominance, because men have tiny, tiny dicks. Anyway.
It's why men rape other men. It's about the feelings of power.
Mm-hmm. Fuck men. Men are the worst. Yeah. If you rape someone, you're the worst.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. Anyway, the probation officer added that Norris, quote, never exhibited any remorse or compassion about his brutal acts towards the victims. The defendant appeared compulsive in his need to inflict pain and torture upon women.
And these are people that have been repeatedly caught and then released back out into society.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with the system. Mm-hmm. In conclusion, the probation officer testified that Norris can realistically be regarded as an extreme sociopath whose depraved pattern of behavior is beyond rehabilitation. Norris was sentenced to 45 years to life imprisonment with eligibility for parole in 2010.
They gonna let him out?
He's eligible for parole. I'll get there. You'll see what happens. On April 24th, 1980, Pataker was arraigned on a total of 29 charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, and murder, in addition to various charges of criminal conspiracy and possession of a firearm. He was also charged with two counts of conspiracy to commit murder, dating from December 1979, in which he had unsuccessfully attempted to persuade two inmates due to be released to murder Robin Robeck in order to prevent her from testifying against him in the trial. The most damning evidence presented at Pataker's trial was a 17-minute section of the audio tape the pair had created at Ledford's abuse and torment. The audio tape, which had been found inside Pataker's van and which Norris had earlier testified Pataker had repeatedly played as he drove in the weeks prior to his arrest, adding that Pataker considered the contents to be real funny, was presented in evidence on January 29th with Stephen Kay forewarning the jury, quote, "For those of you who do not know what hell is like, you'll find out."
Oof.
And then he played the tape.
Oof.
Pataker testified on his own behalf. He denied the abductions and the murders, stating he paid the woman to pose for the Polaroids. He claimed the same for Lamp and Gilliam. His excuse for Ledford was she faked the torture into the recorder in a theatrical way. The trial lasted over 3 weeks, which isn't very long, in my opinion. In the closing argument delivered by the prosecution, Kay apologized to the jury that he was only asking for the death penalty, adding that he wished the law permitted him to request the same suffering be inflicted upon Pataker that he had inflicted upon his victims. Kay then described Pataker as an excuse for a man as he held aloft pictures of each of the five murdered girls before the jury. Kay referred to the case as one of the most shocking, brutal cases in the history of American crime, before adding, if the death penalty is not appropriate in this case, then when will it ever be? So,
fair.
Pro-death.
Fair. Yeah, that's
on
fair.
On February 17, 1981, after deliberating for 3 days, the jury found Pataker guilty of 5 counts of first-degree murder, 1 charge of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, 5 charges of kidnapping, 9 charges of rape, 2 charges of forcible oral copulation, 1 charge of sodomy, 3 charges of unlawful possession of firearms. Pataker was sentenced to death for the 5 counts of first-degree murder upon which the prosecution had sought this penalty. He showed no emotion as the verdict was delivered. He never showed remorse for what he did, ever. He died while incarcerated on death row at San Quentin State Prison on December 13, 2019, at the age of 79. His death was reported as being due to natural causes. Norris was incarcerated at the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility. He died of natural causes at the California Medical Facility on February 24, 2020, at the age of 72. Had been transferred to this facility 1 week prior to his death. So they are both currently dead.
He died.
The end. That's the end of my case.
Wow. You know, you always hear about, like, child rapists and stuff not doing so hot in prison. Because even criminals, you know, nobody likes a child rapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, it's like, yeah, I'll murder some man for cash, but, like, you raped a child, you deserve to, like, be killed in this prison, you know?
Yeah. Hashtag suffer.
Like, there's, like, reasons behind some crimes. Like, imagine you're in prison for just, like, stealing something, and then a child rapist walks in, and you're like, sir, you don't deserve to live anymore, you know?
Yeah. I feel like, you know, if I was in prison, and, you know, I had, like, life sentence, you know, no chance of parole, I'm stuck. That's where it is. That's the end. And I saw, like, a child rapist, like, I would be like, it can't get much worse for me. So,
you start know? Making some shanks.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So, do you have anything you'd like to compare this to?
Well, I've been talking a lot about Criminal Minds. That's what I watch. That's my crime drama. That's what I watch. And it by no means makes me an expert on the psychology of people at all, because it is, in fact, a fictional show. But
what?
Yeah, I know, right? Shocking.
It's crazy.
Crazy. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the things I mentioned before, like, you know, you got escalation, you got power dynamic between these two guys. Obviously, at the end of the trial, you know, okay, I can't pronounce his name either. The guy with the P.
The Taker?
The Taker, okay. Yes. You know, he was, like, throwing Norris under the bus, right? You know?
Norris threw him under the bus.
Oh, Norris threw him under the bus, yes. So, towards the end, Norris was like, yo, I was the subordinate in this relationship. I was.
He's like, all I want to do was rape girls, not kill them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was just following orders. You know, like just doing what this guy said. And yeah, that's nuts. And I'm glad that they are both dead. You know.
Yeah, me too. If 2020 has done anything for us, it's killed Ray Norris.
Yeah, less. One good thing.
Just one. Awesome. Great. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Before I leave, I want to recommend some shows to you and the viewer at home, because I've been watching television. There's a show on Netflix called The Queen's Gambit.
I just finished that yesterday.
Fantastic. I think I'm 2 episodes in. Their episodes are incredibly long. But I love that actress.
There's only 7.
Oh, great. 5 more hours and I'm done.
There you go. You can math.
Yeah. I'm there. I have those abilities. It's really good. It's a great show. I told my mom about it today and she's like, yes, women empowerment. And I'm like, uh-huh. Yes. Get it, mom. But they don't have Netflix, so they can't watch it.
Sad.
What else? The Trial of the Chicago 7. That was really good. Aaron Sorkin. What else did I watch? I watched Moneyball for the first time.
Nice.
Aaron Sorkin. It's a movie.
Okay.
With Brad Pitt. It was nominated for some Oscars. It's got Jonah Hill in it.
Ah.
It's about the Oakland A's and how they used data analytics to win 20 games in a row.
Wow.
Even though they would only they had no money, so they couldn't, like, hire good baseball players, but they used their brains and they got all these underdogs for cheap and they won. So that's cool.
Big data.
It's data. Yeah. Anyway, so this is our Halloween episode. Not very spooky, but
that was spooky.
It's sure scary.
Yeah.
Say that one. What's your favorite scary movie?
Favorite scary movie for Halloween. Mm-hmm. I'm into the classics, you know. I like Corpse Bride and I like Nightmare Before Christmas, which can be either a Christmas or a Halloween movie. It's got that dual purpose. Mm-hmm. I'm not big into horror, but I have heard that both The Haunting of Hill House and The Haunting of Bly Manor on Netflix are fantastic shows to watch if you're into that. I'm a scaredy cat. I like cute Halloween. versus terrify me into having nightmares for weeks Halloween.
All right. I like Scream, which is the origin of What's Your Favorite Scary Movie. Not very scary, but gotta love a meta film. So that's fun. Thank you so much for being my guest on this episode. I hope your hand heals or your finger heals up. Looks awful. Hope you can get back to work sometime soon. To our audience, do not kill anyone. To you too, don't kill anyone. Thank you for listening. If you want to find us on social media, we're Screen of the Crime on most things. If you want to email us, we're screenofthecrimepodcast@gmail.com. You can't find Bella anywhere, but just know that she's here and she exists in the real world. You can probably find her in one of the many photos on my Instagram.
There you go.
Yeah. Have a great Halloween. Don't go out to parties because then you'll spread COVID and you'll make all of us upset. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.